great cities all the way through the tropical belt of the world, both in the New World and in Africa, in Southern Asia and India, and in Southeast Asia. And in fact, the ones, for instance, in Sri Lanka, and particularly the ones in Cambodia, are absolute monsters. That's why I'm interested in them.
The first time in my life, you know, I went to Angkor in year 1994. You know, I'm living in the refugee camp so long time. So when I first time that, and when I went to Angkor, I arrived to Angkor, I'm very happy and very happy. I'm start to draw the, not only Angkor, and all the temple in the period in the Angkor region. I see, oh, in the culture, you know.
An Australian professor of archaeology and a local Cambodian artist, both in awe of the incredible structures and ancient greatness of the medieval capital of Cambodia, the great city of Angkor. As well as the largest religious monument on earth, Angkor Wat, this city, which has been largely reclaimed by the jungle, is the most extensive city of its kind in the pre-industrial world. Associate Professor Roland Fletcher of the University of Sydney is the leader of the Greater Angkor Project. He takes us for a journey through the city's remarkable history and feats.
The main story of Angkor really begins, depending on where you want to start, in the 8th or the 9th century. The current centre of Angkor, which is a location called Nom Bakeng, was actually made the heart of the urban area of Angkor in the late 9th century. And from then on, barring a few small breaks, Angkor remained the key capital. Now, the conventional story is that Angkor dies in the early 15th century. That's the historical story. But it appears that from the archaeological reality, it was operating very much later, and in fact right through into the late 16th century. But by the time you get to the 17th century and certainly the 18th century, the entire region where Angkor is located was largely abandoned, and there was certainly no functioning urban system there. There appear to have been villages with their rice fields around them, but no functioning urban system.
How could such a city with such amazing riches actually decline like that?
Well, I think the first thing to bear in mind, of course, is that we're always surprised by that, but it's actually quite normal. All great pre-industrial cities have really fallen on their faces at one point or another. In Europe, Rome, for instance, Constantinople, classic examples of that. The thing with Angkor is that it is really startling given its magnitude. You're looking, for instance, at an urban core in Angkor where the major monuments are located of nearly 200 square kilometres. And you're looking at a total urban area of nearly 1,000 square kilometres. Now, to get those proportions in people's heads, a pre-industrial capital in Europe like London only covered something like maybe 10, 15 square k, and the great capitals of places like China and Japan, like Chang'an and Edo, which were compact cities with about 1 million human beings in them, only covered 100 square kilometres. So you're dealing with a real monster here.
Can you tell us more about your work there?
The focus on Angkor has always been on these great temples, but in practice, just as in any other great city in the world, the cathedrals or the churches are, of course, only a relatively small proportion of the total place that you're looking at. Angkor was actually a great urban complex with canals 20 kilometres long running across the landscape, people living in houses for kilometres along the edges of roadways and canals, great reservoirs. One of the reservoirs in Angkor is 8 kilometres long and 2 kilometres wide. There's a gigantic urban landscape that surrounds the temples. And in some senses, it's that great construction which is the larger achievement of the medieval Khmer than, in fact, the temples. It's rather disturbing. You look at Angkor Wat, it's considered the largest single religious monument on earth. It's only the medium-sized range of constructions that the Khmer were actually building. So there's plenty else to focus on, and that focus, which is what we're working on at the moment, is actually on the immense level at which the Khmer are managing water and engineering the landscape. They're literally re-engineering whole landscapes.
Do you feel that the Cambodian people might have lost or left that behind? So I can understand moving on from the religious and moving towards maybe a more mercantile economy. But like you're saying, the huge engineering feats, is that a lost art? Is that maybe not talking about a lost city, but a lost art?
It probably isn't a lost art in the sense that much of what you're seeing in these great constructions is simply the standard ways in which you manage water in a rice economy, just blown up onto an enormous scale, inflated to an enormous scale. And the technology is very clever because it is very simple, it's very straightforward, and it works on the principle of slowing down water, bringing water under control, and then dispersing it where you as human beings want it to go on the landscape. The interesting question about it, and it's the thing that the Greater Angkor Project is pursuing, is the problem of whether in the long term this massive infrastructure actually became unusable or actually became unrepairable, and that what was happening was that that system was actually breaking down.
Something that can be learnt with the Three Gorges Dam in Bangladesh?
Well, this is the kind of issue that is beginning to pop up here. We've noticed, for instance, some similarities in the issues being discussed in the Maya world, for example, and in our work in Cambodia, beginning to realize that these big low-density cities massively altered their landscapes for agricultural purposes, removed huge portions of the forest, for example, and vastly removed the forest. There are rice fields of the Angkorian period everywhere in the landscape. And that perhaps what you're seeing is that these big cities excessively modify their landscapes and destabilize their landscapes. And that's one of the things we're trying to investigate in Angkor at the moment. We're not sure that that's what happened. We have some clues that it might be. But the key thing is that it's a very serious issue. If you find out that that is what was happening, then it does have quite considerable implications.
Srey Bandol is a Cambodian artist whose stark black and white pencil drawings of the architecture and figures that make up Angkor goes against the colourful populist art of his peers. He says that he wants to capture the sense of Angkor as being in the past, something of a bygone era, but still monumental and grand in the hearts of his people, the Khmer. His latest book, with academic Ashley Thompson, is titled Looking at Angkor. When you show people your drawings, do they really like the drawings? Do they think it represents Angkor?
No, only some people that love my painting, my drawing. Only some people. And many people, they don't understand that. They don't see.
Why don't they understand?
My drawing is very different from the artists in Cambodia they did. Normally they did like, you know, the painting, the oil painting and depression, the nice color and very hot or nice color. So with my drawing, I use only the pencil. And many of my people, they don't interesting. I think that the first thing, because I have not the money to buy the color. So I think it's better to use only pencil and we can do a good painting, so it's okay. And one more thing, I think the temple they are building in the past tense. So I want to show the people a black and white and some and many light and shadow in the painting. And one more thing, many Khmer people they use the color, so I don't want to be the same the people.
How can the culture and technologies of, say, the ancient Khmer people from 5 centuries ago, and even a lot longer, it seems, what can that do to inspire the Khmer people of today, and what does it still do?
It's an interesting question. There's some argument could be made that in fact, Cambodia as a nation should move away from a focus on Angkor. Angkor's a medieval capital. It's part of an old way of doing things. It was an old method of managing wealth and power founded on rice, for instance, rather than apparently on a mercantile economy. And the world we live in has really changed drastically, as has Cambodian society. These big temples were the temples of Hinduism and of higher level Buddhism. Cambodia today is a society that practices lesser vehicle Buddhism. So in some senses it would be, I think, probably almost desirable for Cambodia to move more to honouring these monuments but not making them really a firm part of Cambodian identity, in effect to move towards other expressions of Cambodian identity, of which there are plenty. There's a very robust cultural system in Cambodia.